This is the Brookings Institution, a private, nonprofit organization devoted to independent research and innovative policy solutions. You're listening to an event sponsored by the Hamilton Project at Brookings. This is part one of Missing Markets, Fostering Market-Based Solutions to Major Risks. This program was recorded on June 5th, 2008.
I'm Jason Furman, the director of the Hamilton Project, and thank you for coming today to our discussion of missing markets. I wanted to explain to you a little bit of the theme of today's event and what ties these disparate papers and concepts together, as well as a number of other papers that the Hamilton Project has released. We all know that markets are the central institution of the economy. They allow people to buy and sell in a way that potentially makes everyone better off. One thing that markets allow people to buy and sell is the risks they face. And people who don't want to face risks can sell them off. And the person who buys them can buy a set of uncorrelated risks and pool them so that it doesn't cost them anything, or in turn sell those risks on to capital markets or others who don't mind bearing them. And a lot of the markets we have today, like health insurance, property insurance, life insurance, are very critical to some of the biggest risks we face. But when you look out and ask what really worries people about what they have to deal with day to day in the economy, and when do they have to make really a financial gamble, when really they're just trying to make a life decision and not make a bet on whether something will go up or down in value, you see places where there are substantial risks that people face, potentially substantial opportunities to address those risks, but for various reasons those markets are missing. And some of our papers are examples like that. So, for example, if you buy a house, you're attached to the neighborhood, the house. You're not necessarily attached to it as a way to, you know, double your money in 2 years, although some people were. And you certainly don't want it as a way to lose half or all of your equity over the course of 2 years. So ways to separate out an investment in a house and the risks that that has with ownership. Same thing with how long you live in the course of your retirement. People don't want to make a bet and a gamble that they're going to live a certain amount of time, and then if they outlive their assets, end up in poverty. And some of the other risks we'll discuss on the second panel, like that affect communities, like if a factory closes or there's a catastrophic hurricane or terrorist attack, are all risks that today people are very exposed to financially. As we think about these papers, a lot of them can be organized into a few different reasons that these markets are missing. First, in some cases, laws or regulations could tilt the playing field against a market that might otherwise come into existence. So Andy Kaplan is going to talk about how if you borrow money on your house, you can deduct the interest. But if you essentially set up a equity type of contract where the lending institution bears some of the risk, you can't deduct that. So that means the government policy favors one type of market over another, and something that potentially might be attractive to people doesn't come into existence. A second is market failures could impede the creation of the market. And these are classic market failures like adverse selection, externalities that we all learn in our introductory economics class. And when we talk about annuities, which Lena will talk about, one of the factors we have there is if you know you're going to live a long time, you might buy the annuities. That will mean the payout on the annuities will be lower, making them less attractive to the average person, leading to a potential spiral that makes that whole market less attractive. Adverse selection is obviously also a very important feature of health insurance and why those markets don't function as well as they could. And the Hamilton Project has talked about a number of ideas to make those markets function better. Finally, those are the classic economic reasons that markets don't exist. But there's a final set that economists are paying increased attention to, which you could think of behavioral obstacles that might impede the creation of valuable markets. So ways in which people systematically misunderstand risks, misperceive intertemporal choices, and as a result, something that really would be worth their buying, something that ex post they would have wished they bought, they may not buy in advance. Now, one has to be very careful. It's easy as an economist to say, you should buy this, you'd be better off. And then the product comes into existence and it doesn't pass a market test because it turns out people didn't really like it. But there are certain systematic biases, and this certainly affects the way people save and some of the ideas that the Retirement Security Project and the Hamilton Project have released on automatic IRAs. Is a way to address that those behavioral obstacles by changing defaults for saving, and the annuities paper we're going to hear about today fits into that category as well. Conclusion, I don't want to argue that markets are the solution to all the world's problems, and I certainly don't want to argue that free markets are by themselves completely sufficient to solve every problem. In a lot of cases, the government has a very vital role to play to foster those markets, and in particular, some of the biggest risks that we face as individuals and communities. So let me very briefly now introduce the folks on stage. We're going to hear presentations of two papers now. This panel is focused on the risks that individuals face, followed by two discussants, and then we'll have a break, and the second panel talks more about the risks that communities face, although those risks obviously ultimately translate down to individuals as well. And you probably have more detailed bios in your material, so let me just briefly say that we'll start with Andrew Kaplan, who's a professor of economics at New York University, talking about shared equity mortgages. Then Lena Walker, on behalf of a team of people at the Retirement Security Project, where she serves as research director, will present an idea about trial annuities. Mark Ivery is a co-author of that paper and will participate in the group discussion and the audience Q&A on that paper. And then our two discussants are Harvey Blitz, who is Senior Vice President of AXA Equitable Life Insurance Company and can give us a little bit of a market perspective on some of these products, and Doug Elmendorf, who's a Senior Fellow in the Economic Studies Program at Brookings. So thank you, and Andy, we can start with you.
So this is the case for shared equity mortgages. My co-authors, Noel Cunningham, Mitch Engler of NYU Law School, and Frederick Pollock of Morgan Stanley. This is an idea whose time, I believe, has come. And it's the idea is, in a nutshell, incredibly simple, which is that when you're taking on a risky investment, you typically have some mix of debt and equity if you're a company. You raise something from people who will share the risk with you, and you take on a certain amount of the risk yourself in the form of debt. Why not for housing? Why not when you buy a home? It's a risky investment. Why isn't that available? I believe that lack of availability of these mortgages underlies a significant amount of the recent problem in the U.S., and I want to point out why, in essence, they've been ruled out in the U.S. by fiat and how that could be changed. What is a shared equity mortgage? Well, consider you're buying a house. You're buying a house, and you're going to go along and bring a 10% down payment. Typically, you'd have to get a 90% mortgage, end up in a very risky situation with a lot. You've got to pay back all the 90%. Here's what you're going to do in the world of shared equity mortgages. You're going to cut down your borrowing to only 70%. The 20% that you need in addition will come from something called a shared equity mortgage. So that would be 40,000. The numbers here are correct. Don't try reading the ones in the folder. They might confuse you. These ones actually look real. 40,000 for 20% of a house initially valued at $200,000. Suppose that 10 years later that house is sold for $300,000. There are two different ways, very simple ways, that you could make for sharing of equity with the lender. One of them would be share the appreciation. This is called a shared appreciation mortgage. Pay back $40,000 plus 50% of the gain, say. You borrowed 20%, you pay back 50% of the gain, that's much more, a larger share. You pay back $90,000. In different ways, you simply have an incrementing share of the house that you owe over time. So that by the time 10 years is up, you might owe, say, 30% of the house value, having borrowed 20%. All of these are in lieu of rent, in essence. And again, you pay back the same amount. Two different pricing mechanisms, simple, mechanical. You can work out what you own, what you owe. Why? Why would we do that? Why wouldn't we stick with current mortgage contracts? Well, I think people by now know that the full risk of house price movements in the current market is borne by the borrower, that you borrowed 95% or 90%, and the entire margin goes to you. It's very unusual in our financial system to ask somebody who has little cash to go full debt. They typically would say they'd find a friend or they'd find some equity version of starting a company. You'd lose a little bit of equity, not apparently buying a house. So what would happen? I have to say would, don't yet exist. Obviously, the first order effect is that you're going to reduce the chance of being underwater because you're not borrowing up to 90%, you're only borrowing up to 70% in the standard way. If house values go down, the shared equity techniques mean that your cost of capital as a borrower was lower. So as house prices go down, so your costs go down. That's good. That's called diversification. That's why equity is useful. Obviously, that reduces the risk of a default-driven housing crisis. They also lower the down payment, so it's a way of getting a down payment down without increasing systemic risk. Literally, there is no other way in a debt market. If you want to get down payments down, you have to increase systemic risk. The crisis is inevitable in the result in a world in which it's a debt-only world. I don't see how you could avoid what just happened as you expand the margins of borrowing and using pure debt instruments. At some point, there will be a large number of defaults. That's inevitable, given the nature of lending institutions. So you're now being able to lower down payments without raising the risk of borrowers going underwater. You've raised affordability without raising risk. Why is that in the news right now? Just a little bit. I mean, I'd like it to be a lot more in the news. I mean, I think these are ideas whose time has come. The way it's currently coming in is that Congress has figured out that, wow, we're in a crisis. It looks like people holding debts aren't worth, these debts aren't worth what's written on them. Maybe we should write them down. Everybody's being encouraged to write down debt. But if they write down their debt, why should the only beneficiary be the person who had the debt written down for them, that one individual? Why shouldn't, if everybody else chipped in, if a Norwegian pension fund chipped in and agreed to take a big write down, why should it not benefit from the increase in prices later? These are certainly something of interest to home buyers. I'm speeding up. They're of interest to home buyers. I've done surveys. I've been thinking about them a while. But let me just give you a little lesson. They were introduced in the US in the 1980s. They're not very unfamiliar instruments. And they failed. There was a reintroduction attempted by Bear Stearns in the 1990s that failed. And I would like to argue that history could be very different if they'd succeeded. They tried to package them in shared equity securities. Why did it fail? Well, there are two tax obstacles in the US. First off, in 1980, when first introduced, shared appreciation mortgages, it was asked, are they debt or are they equity? Now, apparently, that's a decision that matters a lot for tax treatment. You're either filing as an individual homeowner or as a partnership. You can't even file taxes if you don't know debt or equity. So the IRS said, we rule debt for a very specific instrument. We immediately shift this to the no ruling list. On the no ruling list, you will hear absolutely nothing about your product should you innovate. You will not know if it's debtor equity. You will not know how to file. Bear Stearns put warnings saying you have to consult your accountant to decide if you can take this product out, basically. So nobody wanted it. Tax uncertainties. And if those uncertainties were removed, the likelihood is, I found out in communication with Treasury, preliminary, that it would be likely negatively treated. So right now, what's wrong is all this stuff. What should we do? Regulatory authority exists with Treasury. Legislation, public awareness, change the tax regime.
Thank you. Lena, I think, are you?
Mm-hmm. Okay. I'll have
both. And do I press up and down? So over the next 20 years, about 75 million workers will retire. And for a while, a lot of the conversation was focused on whether these workers are saving enough for retirement. But when we consider the broader question of retirement security, it's not just whether you're saving enough that matters, but also whether you're drawing down your assets and taking your retirement distribution in a manner that minimizes your risk. Thank you. In a manner that minimizes your risk and is appropriate to your needs. Now, I think we can all agree that blowing all your saving on a boat when you reach 70, it's not a good strategy. But neither is being too conservative and living very meagerly in retirement. And I know that these are extreme examples, but they make the point that for a retiree's distribution choice will affect his or her retirement outcome. And today, my co-authors, Bill Gale, Mark Every, David John, and myself, present a proposal that provides retirees with the tools to help them make better, more informed distribution choices. Now, you might ask, why are we focusing on this question today? The short answer is that the retirement landscape has changed, and retirement planning tools and strategies will have to change as well. We know, for instance, that there's been a shift from DB to DC coverage, and so that has resulted in a decline in lifetime pensions. We know that many workers are saving in 401k plans, so future workers will retire with large balances in their accounts, and they need to manage these resources. We also know that retirees are living longer, but they don't know exactly how much longer. And so they'll have to manage these resources over an uncertain lifetime, and they risk the possibility of spending too much too soon or too little over time. Lifetime income products can reduce some of the complexity of retirement planning. Now, the way it works is you exchange a portion of your assets, and in return, you get guaranteed payments for life. So for the retiree, it mitigates or reduces their chance of outliving their resources. Yet we know that demand is low, and the research has pointed to three important reasons why this might be the case. Retirees will receive lifetime income benefits through the Social Security system. And so for many, this might be sufficient annuitization. We also know that current lifetime income products are priced to reflect the longer lifespan of current buyers. So this means that for the average consumer, it's not a very good deal. This is the adverse selection problem. And we also know that these products are complicated and consumers don't understand it, and they're, for various reasons, biased against it. So what this means, though, is that if there is a way to lower prices to mitigate some of that adverse selection, if there is a way to circumvent or so correct these biases, consumers will be better off with additional annuitization. Now, it's true that the market has been evolving, and there are products in the market that would address some of these biases, but we believe that a market solution alone is not enough. It's not going to help address some of the misunderstandings and misperceptions about these products, and unless it increases substantially, it's not going to mitigate the adverse selection problem. You still face high prices. So we think some kind of policy intervention will be necessary. So we take, at the Retirement Security Project and all four authors, we take seriously those three reasons why the market is limited. And we build our policy on top of it. So we feel that the best way to help consumers understand these products and to overcome their biases is to give them a chance to try it out temporarily so they can test drive it, so to speak. And we also know that it's important to increase the pool of consumers to lower prices. We know that there'll be millions of participants in 401k plans. And so this is a natural launching point for our proposal. But under the current structure of 401k plans, it's actually not easy to access lifetime income products. And so we're recommending automatic features in the distribution stage to make it easier. And we get that not all consumers are the same and that they all have different needs for annuitization, so we make the proposal voluntary. Consumers and retirees can opt out if they want to. Our proposal is the automatic trial income payment. Very simply, when the worker is ready to take distributions, a substantial portion of their 401k balance will be automatically deposited, will be defaulted into a 2-year trial income payment. They can opt out if they want to, or they can, if they make no selection, they will receive 24 consecutive monthly payments. After 2 years, the trial ends, and participants can elect a different distribution option, or if they do nothing and make no election, they will be automatically defaulted into a permanent income option. So the proposal is not a mandate. Employers will be encouraged to participate, and they'll have discretion over some of the structure and implementation of the payment option. So we want to make the point that the idea behind this proposal is that we want to give retirees the opportunity to experience the benefits of guaranteed monthly payments. Everybody, a lot of workers under the proposal will be receiving lifetime income payments. It will correct any misperceptions they have about these products. It will reframe the way they think about income distributions. And it levels the playing field for lifetime income products. So the goal for us is that during this trial period, retirees will be able to acquire more information, they'll have more time to evaluate the distribution options, and when it comes time to take final distributions, they'll be more informed. And because we believe that retirees have underappreciated the value of lifetime income products, we want to make it easier for them to access these products, and we do so with automatic features.
Thank you, Lena.
Thank you.
Doug, why don't we start with you for the comments?
So I'm going to talk briefly about the shared equity mortgages, and I commend Andrew and his co-authors for their work in this area. Andrew's been advocating shared equity mortgages for, I think, a dozen years now, and has really been a voice in the wilderness for much of that time. But I think we are fortunate that he is not easily deterred, because shared equity mortgages, I think, are a very sensible idea. And I hope that the authors are successful in expanding their use. Having said that, it probably isn't very interesting if I just sit here and echo Andrew's positive comments about the benefits of shared equity mortgages. So let me mention briefly a few costs. I do not think these costs should prevent the spread of shared equity mortgages, but I think they should damp down the speed and extent of that spread. The first cost is that separating the owner occupancy of a home from the ownership of the asset to some extent, as this proposal does, has some disadvantages as well as some advantages. The clear advantage, as Andrew points out, is that it reduces the risk that homeowners bear. The disadvantage is that by insulating homeowners from the part of the change in the value of the property, we're reducing their incentive to make the upkeep and improvements they would otherwise have an incentive to do. There's a reason that homeownership exists. The benefit of collecting together the occupancy and the ownership decision is that it removes the landlord-tenant tension about what to do with the property and what care to take of it. And the extent to which we separate those, we are reducing that incentive. A second issue is that people's ability to refinance mortgages when they choose to affects the risk sharing I think you can get out of shared equity mortgages. People don't have to sign up for these mortgages and hold them for a long period of time through ups and downs in the market. The way mortgages normally work, if applied to these types of mortgages, mean that homeowners will tend to shift into conventional debt-only mortgages when they expect house prices to go up so that they capture most of the appreciation. Then they'll look for shared equity mortgages when home prices are expected to go down so that they can lay off some of that loss on the lenders. Now, of course, the lenders will anticipate that, so they will price the mortgages at different points in the house price cycle differently. I can't do the math to figure out where that will all settle out. I think it's quite complicated, but my presumption is that the outcome would be ultimately less risk sharing than one might otherwise think if people were forced to hold these mortgages for a long period of time without refinancing. I think a third complication is that shared equity mortgages are themselves complicated. One lesson of this mortgage mess and of separate economic research is that people do not understand the more subtle features of their mortgages. And I think the appropriate policy response, viewing conventional mortgages, is to try to guide people into mortgages that are better for them. And the corresponding issue for shared equity mortgages is to figure out the sorts of disclosures and education that are needed and to decide what limitations regulators might impose on the terms and structure of these mortgages. I think the fourth cost I would mention is that American households have traditionally done a considerable share of their life cycle saving by paying down a mortgage and building up equity in their homes. People have worried that home equity credit lines and other mechanisms for tapping into one's home equity will end up with Americans close to retirement having done less saving than they expected to do. And I think a very similar problem arises here. By signing over some share of one's home equity or the appreciation of one's home to a lender, homeowners might end up at retirement, perhaps selling their homes, and ending up with less resources than they had anticipated. So I think as we expand shared equity mortgages, we need to be sure we're finding ways to replace the forced saving of the current mortgages that is essentially being lost. So just to say at the end, I really hope very much that we expand the role of shared equity mortgages. I think these are my concerns are considerations we should keep in mind as we do that, just to be sure that these mortgages really are a boon for homeowners and don't end up being costly in ways that are not anticipated. Thank you.
Well, before talking about going back to annuities, do you want to speculate about how you could address any of the challenges that Doug laid out for you? Or if you want more time, while Harvey's talking.
Forgetting is a much bigger risk than anything else. It's like I've got to keep track. So I think Doug and I would kind of line up very similarly on this. I mean, the idea that 100% always forever was the correct equity number is too bizarre to even countenance. It's just an institutional restriction to 100%. We don't force entrepreneurs to bear all marginal risks. And if we really believed that you had to face full risk before you had incentives, you know, capitalism wouldn't exist. So this is kind of bringing that level of capitalism down to a smaller level, the level that it's a little bit more what people care about. Then would prices vary over the cycle? You'd expect so, and I think that's an interesting question as to whether you'd like to impose constraints and how that would play in. I do think that for complexity, I'm in favor of much education, responsibility resting where it must, which is both with the individual as they take the product out and with the regulators for setting up a coherent general body of restrictions. It's not about shared equity mortgages. There are new products every day. You have to be able to understand them. At the same time, there have to be rules about how they're presented. I wouldn't even mind if one insisted on taking a test to take out many financial products. I don't think that's an issue that should stop innovation. It should give us pause about the quality of education. And then how do we get to the next level where people actually understand? And how do we prevent people from lying? But those are generic issues.
Great. Well, and we'll come back to some of that as we discuss and open up. But Harvey, why don't you?
Thank you. When I was asked to comment on this paper, The Brookings Institution did not ask me what my view of annuitization was, although I imagine that knowing that I worked at a life insurance company, they probably thought they were on fairly safe ground, and they were, at least in the sense that I agree with the basic principle of the paper, which is that more annuitization coming out of 401ks is a good idea, particularly in today's environment where defined benefit pension plans, which used to provide a lifetime income for lots of people who are working in companies, no longer does that. The government sector is about the only one that has a lot of that going forward today. So the idea that 401ks become the central retirement depository for employed people is more and more true, and the idea that some portion of that, and they cleverly provide only a portion of what's in the 401k, should turn into lifetime income is, I think, a very good idea. I have a lot of comments on how to make the proposal work better. I'm just going to give you a few of the highlights this morning, and I'll give them privately a few more. The first thing I want to note is that they focus on 401ks, which is a good idea, but there are other kinds of pension plans today that have very little in the way of lifetime income distribution, like cash balance and hybrid plans, which are really maybe even more natural kinds of vehicles in which to put in this kind of a proposal. And so you might want to think about, in fact, expanding it that way. And another comment I'd make up front is this proposal is totally voluntary. That means that unless a plan sponsor chooses on their own to offer this, it simply doesn't happen. I'm going to support that in a moment, but first I want to say that even before you put in this default option, which is the basic principle, that people will default into an annuity, you have to recognize the problem that almost all 401k plans today don't even have annuities as an option that they give their participants when they retire. All they do is say, you get a lump sum, and what you do with your money is your problem. And we might want to think about at least requiring that plans offer an annuity as an option to their participants for two reasons. One of them is that it would help educate the participants about the ideas of annuities before they actually reach retirement, and this proposal kicks in. In this proposal, the first time the participant hears about the annuity option is basically when it triggers. And it seems to me that if you have an annuity option in the plan from the beginning, all the education they get about how their 401k plan works will include annuities as an option. The second reason has to do with sponsors. I think it's a pretty big leap for sponsors to voluntarily put this in and add it to a plan that doesn't even have annuity, to go from no annuity option at all to, oh, not only is there an annuity option, but you default right into it. And a middle step is at least getting plan sponsors more educated, more familiar with annuities. The other thing I want to say about voluntary sponsor participation is that based on my experience, we need to do two things. We need to find a way to make plan sponsors comfortable that if they act reasonably in putting this in place, they're not going to end up with legal liability. ERISA sets a very high fiduciary standard, and I don't want to lower the standard. I just want to make it easier for plan sponsors to meet it by creating a regulatory structure that makes that simpler. And the second thing is the authors have put on the plan sponsor the responsibility for deciding a lot of details about this program. For instance, they say, well, the portion of the 401k that's going to end up involved in this default annuity can range from, in their paper, 33% to 75%, which is a very, very broad range. And then they say, oh, and the plan sponsor will pick the number. Plan sponsors aren't going to want to try to pick a number out of a 33 to 75% range. You probably want to think, A, about narrowing the range, or maybe even mandating it at some number like 40%, or some number that, in fact, will accomplish a lot of the purpose without adding a lot of complexity in the plan sponsor choice. And you can give the plan sponsor the right to change that number, but at least if you give them guidance as to what a normal number would be, it's going to get easier to do this. For large plan sponsors, maybe it won't matter. But they want to apply this across a fairly broad range of 401ks. There are proposals to not include very small employers, which I support. But if you're going to have a broad range of sponsors covered by this, you need to make it simple. There's some discussion in the paper about, and in the presentation this morning, about the provider marketplace and how today it's, I guess they'd call it inadequate. I don't want to characterize whether that's true or not. I think the market is clearly not robust enough today to cover this proposal. What I do want to say is that if this proposal were in effect, I'm highly confident that the provider marketplace would become robust enough to offer a fair and efficient solution to what's being designed here. And I say that not just based on speculation. I say that based, first of all, on the fact that in group life and group disability, you have very, very large, competitive, and efficient marketplaces that work. And so if more people, in fact, were annuitizing, this would, in fact, happen. Beyond that, I know that many companies today, mine included, are actually looking at ways, independent of this paper, of providing, working with plan sponsors in 401ks to provide distribution annuity options to their employees outside the plan structure, sort of as a advisory kind of rollover vehicle. And so it's happening already. It certainly would be accelerated significantly by this proposal. The final point I want to make, well, there are two actually, but the second, the penultimate point I want to make has to do with the two-year trial. I think the two-year trial is brilliant. It gives people a chance to see whether or not their lifetime income without locking into a vehicle for the rest of their life. And then at the end of the 2 years, it gives them the opportunity to opt out. That structure creates very difficult problems for the provider in terms of the investment philosophy and the that they're going to use for this product. A two-year, if you think about it, you're making an investment day one, but you can walk away at the end of 2 years. That's a very difficult disintermediation problem people won't lightly take on. And I think the way you actually fix that problem, which is suggested at least in a footnote in the paper, is to think about the two-year trial period as not really being a life annuity. It's really going to be some kind of distribution option out of the account balance, which converts into a lifetime annuity only at the end of the two-year period. And the final point I want to make is there's a discussion, an important discussion in the paper, about guarantees. The authors are concerned that we're going to put all these people into annuity contracts provided by private providers, and if those providers fail, people won't get their money. That is a bona fide concern. I think, personally, that it's a little overstated in the sense that there's a current process, a current program for guaranteeing insurance company obligations that's a state-run program that, in fact, has worked extremely well. When even large failures occurred, like Executive Life a while ago, the guarantee program stepped up and actually handled the problem in a way that was very satisfactory for the people who had insurance and annuity contracts from Executive Life. But I think the solution to this, there needs to be a solution to this problem, but I think it can, in fact, be a relatively simple one. The authors had suggested a pre-funded solution, sort of like FDIC. I think in this case, you don't have to be pre-funded. One of the important things is that the payments that have to be made if a provider failed are being paid over a long period of time. So unlike a bank account, where when the bank goes bankrupt, you have to be able to give every nickel of that fund, here what you're guaranteeing are the benefits. So you actually have some time to accumulate the funds you need. You don't necessarily have to pre-fund it. And there's a proposal mentioned in the article for creating an optional federal charter for insurers. Insurers today are, in fact, state regulated. And there's a proposal in Congress now to make this federal regulation. And I believe that federal regulation would, in fact, make finding a solution to the guarantee problem much simpler. Thank you.
So Mark and Lena, those were mostly in the form of friendly amendments. So,
yeah.
But if you want to amend the amendments, or
sure. How could we resist? We're first of all heartened by Harvey's central point that he likes the concept of the two-year trial income arrangement, and in particularly given his prominent role in the provider industry, that he thinks that instituting that could promote a significant expansion of the market, the group market for lifetime income products, you know, that this would help develop the market. And we very much recognize what Harvey was saying, that there is a very dynamic, creative locus of activity now in terms of new annuity products in the 401k space, that industry is developing annuities that are being considered and adopted by employers sponsoring 401k plans. This is just starting out, but it is definitely on an upward curve. Harvey mentioned outside the plan, many of these employers that are starting to offer an annuity option in their 401ks are doing it with a platform that in effect tells people when you retire, when you leave, here's some annuity options that the employer has effectively vetted and that are being presented in a reasonably comparable apples to apples simple way so folks can compare different options, kind of bringing a simplified marketplace to the individual. Our two-year trial approach actually works in the first instance inside the plan so that before the person retires or at the time they retire, they're given this two-year trial. It's not necessarily outside the scope of the plan because after the 2 years, they have another election administered by the plan sponsor where they could opt out of the insurance or annuity product altogether. The thought of requiring plans to have an annuity, 401ks, to have an annuity option is an interesting one, and we should all think about that further. I think two issues I would raise that I'm looking forward to talking about.
He's a discussant on my paper.
Over time, if you require an annuity to be introduced in a 401k, you don't necessarily get education of participants if it's just an option. We had more annuities in 401ks until the Treasury, and I'll fess up, I made this decision in the federal government 10 years ago, allowed people to get rid of their annuities in 401k plans. For my sins, I'm a co-author of this proposal. And we found that the result of having an annuity that no one elected, because we weren't thinking behaviorally, we weren't thinking strategically about how to encourage it in the plan, was that they didn't get education about the annuity, it was ignored, and implanting the annuity option in the plan did not endear the annuity to the plan sponsor. Plan sponsors wanted it out in the interest of simplification. So we should talk about that further and figure out whether there's a way to do that. Finally, I would note, I think it's a great idea that Harvey mentioned of taking the trial income concept into the defined benefit space. Defined benefit plans, particularly cash balance hybrid plans, already have the annuity option. So I think your point is extremely well taken. That's a fertile ground for introducing such a behavioral strategy. And one of our two subsequent papers in progress is actually going to be trying that idea out.
Thank you. So we'll start with some questions. And one of the first questions an economist should always ask when you see a proposal like this is, if it's such a great idea, why doesn't it exist already? Now, the authors have identified some of those reasons and some of those obstacles. But I think what I want to probe a little bit is whether those reasons and obstacles are sufficient. So in the case of annuities, first of all, there's just the whole set of administrative costs associated with it. So even if you got rid of all the adverse selection, if you turn over $100 of annuities, you'll get back the equivalent of $90 in present value, or give or take, if you tell me the exact number, over the course of the rest of your life. And you obviously get something in exchange for that in terms of this insurance. But is that just that purely sort of administrative cost and set of transaction costs associated with it enough to be a decent reason that people don't get something, especially when people might want to keep a big lump sum of money around in case a catastrophic medical event or for many of the other reasons. Then The reason that might make one worry is that you would then maybe be defaulting someone into something that actually might not be a good idea for them, and people would get stuck in something that would make them worse off. When it comes to 401ks, you have a little bit of confidence because when people are forced to make a decision, they make about the same decision as if they're automatically enrolled in a 401k as opposed to the opposite. So you sort of feel like maybe that's the right decision. Do you have a corresponding thing here? Then the second question related to that is, and we had all of our papers are vetted by discussants in a closed door, small meeting, and one of the ones in that, Jeff Brown, argued very strongly that the market in this area is particularly innovative and coming up with new ideas to make annuities look more attractive and actually be more attractive and address some of the worries and concerns people have with them, like they're losing any chance of the upside appreciation or these lump sums of money they might need if something really big comes up. Do you think that innovation would be sufficient? Do you think there's any trade-off between your type of plan and a plan that could it stifle that form of innovation, or could it foster it? And how do you think of this plan in a really dynamic marketplace? So why don't we start with some of those?
Want me to take a step?
Yeah, go ahead.
All right. So you had two questions. I'll address the second question first, which is the question about market innovation. Would it be reasonable to let the market evolve on its own? Do we need some kind of intervention? I think that it's true that a lot of individuals have some kind of biases about annuities. They might be worried that they'll get hit by a bus the day after they buy the product. And you're right that a lot of these products have addressed some of these biases. So you have death benefits or you have guarantees. But a lot of consumers are not that savvy and are not cognizant of the changes that are happening in the annuity market today. And so when they make the decision about whether or not to annuitize the retirement assets, a lot of it will be based on what they perceive the value of the product to be rather than what it actually is or is available to them. So in that sense, I think that there is a lag in their perception of what's happening and that they're more likely to still consider it a bad value even though there are better products available. And because of that, it will take a while for them to start sort of appreciating the value of lifetime income products. And unless you have sufficient volume, you're not going to mitigate the adverse selection problem. Prices would still be high. You would still have a very select group of individuals who would be buying these products. And it just, for the average person with average or less than average life expectancy, it's not going to be a good value. The first question relates to administrative cost. So even if we were to mitigate completely the adverse selection and we have a very large pool of consumers, there would still be administrative cost, and would that still be a good value for consumers? I think it's important to remember that we are proposing that this product be administered through 401k plans. So it is a group market, and there's a lot of benefits to having group pricing. And there are economies of scale associated with that would reduce the administrative cost. And in fact, a conversation with Harvey earlier, he talked about how efficient the life group market is. And I think that with sufficient competition, sufficient volume, you would get an annuity or lifetime income market that is as efficient as the group market, life group market.
Mm-hmm. Ed Mugg, you want to?
Go ahead.
I had two comments on points Lena actually didn't discuss in your comments. One was, you mentioned in passing upside appreciation, and I think it's worthwhile at least putting on the table that there's the opportunity here to have a variable lifetime payout with a floor guarantee, which is a common kind of product that's being offered today, as well as a fixed one. And so, in fact, people who would like to see upside appreciation or people who want inflation kind of protection, there will, in fact, be vehicles like that. But the thing that fascinated me about what you said most was the comment about default, and maybe we're going to default somebody into where they don't want to be. It seems to me it's all a question of perspective. It's true that today the 401k has a lump sum option as the general form of payment. But think about defined benefit plans. In a traditional defined benefit plan, you've defaulted everybody by rule, if you like, if you don't have a lump sum option. into exactly this kind of benefit. And so if you think about 401ks now, as sort of the whole underlying theoretical premise of this paper is that we need to take at least a part of the 401k balance and say it's replacing the defined benefit plan kind of structure that no longer exists, then in fact defaulting everybody into a lump sum payment may not be the right choice, and in fact some mix between lump sum and lifetime payout as this paper proposes might make much more sense.
Jason.
Doug, if you want to.
I said one thing. I think you should be a little careful about, I think, describing the world as one in which people are just sort of being moved from what had been annuitized wealth into unannuitized wealth. That's true for the shift from defined benefit to defined contribution pension plans. But simultaneously, we're having a rising share of health spending in people's retirement consumption bundles. And that health spending is largely paid for and ever more paid for by the government through Medicare in what is essentially an annuitized form. So I think it's certainly true that the shift of the cash income and the ability to buy other things has moved in a very moved away from annuitization. I think it's worth pushing that back. Mm-hmm. I think we should just be careful not to describe that the only thing which is going on is just a headlong dash away from annuitization, because there is another rather important feature, I think, mm-hmm. that we're seeing. Yeah.
I wanted to, if I could move on, and we'll come back to some of these issues. If you take my typology at the beginning, so some markets don't exist because regulations get in their way, and your paper is very much in that, some because of market failures, and some because of behavioral obstacles. If we got rid of all the regulations and made this on a level playing field with debt mortgages, would you be concerned that there are any market failures that would get in the way, and would you be concerned especially about whether there were any behavioral obstacles? Or put another way, would this take off like wildfire because it's the best product ever and it's just disadvantaged right now? And if it wouldn't, what else would we need to do to make this work? Or would we conclude that it actually wasn't so great because it failed a market test on a level playing field?
It's a great question, and it's the heart of the matter as to kind of seeing this in a level world. You just get this option, it's a new option to take out a mortgage, investors sitting there waiting somehow. Is it just going to fly? Well, my own take is that you need the design phase to be very careful. And then it will fly. So let me give you the simplest of examples. The ultimate investor in this product should be me. I'm the one who should be investing. I've got two daughters. I want them to be able to buy homes in Manhattan. That's looking difficult. If you said to me I could put some money into an investment that was guaranteed to stay ahead of New York real estate, because it is an investment in New York real estate, I would be there in a flash. Now, how you write the rules so that that form of market sets up is subtle. You have to sit down and do that. What you're looking for is a long-term investor in this form of residential real estate. You also need an education process, and that will not be instantaneous, around the advantages for large institutions in diversifying into real estate. But the point is, it's not. So here's a smash. Here's the type of investment that takes off in 10 minutes. You know, buy this, it'll give you a 200% return tomorrow. That's the prospectus that wins. The prospectus that doesn't win is, you know, diversify into this nice spinach-like asset that will, it's good for you and will kind of, so that, you know, the nature of this long-term is, you know, it's spinach, it's good for you. The nature of it short-term has to be a sharp need that somebody feels. You have to, one of the reasons you need the playing field to have been opened up very wide is that you need exploration and you need thought given to all the different types of market this could become. It would be a very intricate set of markets. It also would form the basis for house price insurance. One of the troubles with current schemes in house price insurance is that, as it would, they say there's no primary asset. And nobody knows exactly what they're bundling on the other side. So now you've got all these mortgages coming together. They're very much tied to local house prices. You can now start investing in them and shorting them and doing all kinds of fancy things with them. And now you can create house price insurance products just from the fact that the fundamentals are out there in the marketplace.
Mm-hmm. Now, when you talk about getting the details right in the educational campaign, are you saying there'll be five different companies competing, and the one that gets the details right and has the best advertising campaign will make the biggest profits and thrive, and so the market will establish itself? Or are you saying, you know, we would need a government education campaign and to set the parameters of the policy exactly right?
I mean a mix. So the mix would be that early days, a lot of thought has to be given, in essence, by governmental institutions, because the ability to do this, I mean, I understand the line that, you know, the problems that we've been facing come from under-regulation, but anybody who's ever tried to introduce a consumer financial product knows that isn't the whole truth. Every single product you would design will run into 4,000 types of block, and which investors will be allowed to invest in it will be decided by a committee that doesn't understand the product, excuse me. So basically you're going to have to run a large, the first stage has to be clearing away of a lot of minefields. With the minefields cleared away, open a competitive market, it will fly.
Okay. One obstacle that has come up on both sides today and will come up on our next panel in terms of catastrophic insurance and will come up in August when we release papers on infrastructure, including pay-as-you-drive insurance by Jason Bordoff and Pascal Noel, is state-chartered insurance companies and the way in which those state regulations can sometimes act as an obstacle to these products and the option of creating a national charter and allowing things to be done under that. I don't know if any of you wanted to comment more broadly on that idea, how important you think it is, you know, what you think the argument for the existing system is.
I'd be happy to say that I don't know how it affects your particular circumstance. You might want to answer that first. But the point I was going to make is that in a general sense, if you want to have a national marketplace, if you're this kind of an idea, which would need to be implemented in a national way, to the extent there's an insurance element, the process of getting 50 state approvals guarantees to slow it down. And I can tell you for my company that we're selling in 44 states a product that we brought out a year ago, and in six states we're selling the generation of the product that came before. And in New York, we're still selling the product we brought out in 2001 because they won't approve any of the ones that came thereafter. So it is a guarantee for difficulty in getting a single nationwide standard.
So I've run into this. In Syracuse, New York, participated in the design of a home price insurance scheme where the first thing the regulators told us, it was done for public policy reasons, the first thing that the regulators told us is you've misnamed your product. You don't want to meet us. So what can we call it? Maybe assurance. So now it's been called home price assurance. Maybe we can actually issue it. And the answer is no. So why couldn't we issue the product we were thinking of issuing? The product would have said roughly, you owe less money back if home prices fall in your district. It's a mortgage where the balance due depends on what happens in the district, and it has direct insurance written in relative to house price falls in your area. You would think that would be a good idea and one that would be approved, but in New York State, first off, we had to steer by the insurance. They said, stay out of our office, we're worrying. Then we went to describe other, to find out what other financial product this might be called. And we found out that it would be described as a price level adjusted mortgage. Okay. If it's a price level adjusted mortgage, it's already illegal in New York State. Why? Because something happened in 1980 that got somebody worried and they wrote a law. So it's dead. Now, if you have to go around every single office to find out what your product is going to be called, you'll probably, after the event, be told you misclassified it.
It's fairly difficult.
Right. There's a question of whether you'd have confidence that the National Charter would get all of that right. But why don't we open up to audience questions? Some people have microphones, so identify your name, your institution, and if you're directing it to a particular person. So, the gentleman in the back.
Mike Wyan with BNA Pension and Benefits. And this question is directed to Harvey. Yesterday I covered an event at which an individual who was there and has significant responsibilities associated with profit sharing and 401k plans. And I asked this individual the question of what makes people think after living a lifetime on a monthly paycheck that they can all of a sudden take out all this money and manage it themselves? Why don't they annuitize? And his response was, in a word, or in two words, no trust. And I think that your suggestion of some sort of guarantee or mechanism may go towards assisting in that effort. Do you agree?
Yes, I certainly do. I mean, if we're going to create a system like this through law, then we need to make sure that people have, you know, very, very high confidence that these payments are going to be made. The best form of that guarantee needs to be thought through, and I think maybe one of your succeeding papers can, in fact, focus on that. But the idea of having some kind of certainty for these people is very, very important.
Mike, I would just suggest as a follow-up to Harvey's answer that it's not only no trust in the insurance provider. We know that, in fact, there have not been very many failures of major insurance carriers, and there are some safeguards, state guarantee pools, et cetera, though we think that the trust does need to be enhanced, and that's why we discuss that additional safety as an objective and talk about ways to do that. But it's also the framing. I mean, if humor is all about timing, choice is all about framing, and the framing of the lump sum versus annuity decision is heavily tilted away from the annuity for a whole raft of reasons, which we don't have time to go into. But the trust or the mistrust is just one of them. You know, there are another 9 or 10 factors that all tilt individuals in favor of that lump sum, including the wealth illusion, you know, the sense that you've got your $100,000 or $500,000 balance, and when they tell you how much of an annuity that would buy, it sounds like a pittance on a monthly basis compared to this large sum of money. People aren't used to having the decision framed effectively, and our proposal seeks to both frame it in advance, which is giving people a monthly income pension paycheck statement of what they've got, not just an account balance, but more importantly, framing it in an actual action-oriented way. Learn by doing. See what it feels like to have 2 years of regular monthly payments coming to you, and whether that reframes the decision for people, then give them the option to go ahead with it for life or not.
So, another question, sir?
She's coming.
Jia Chen, Bethesda Manon. My question is for Dr. Walker. Harvey mentioned the word comfortable, and then he mentioned, we heard in the question answer, and he gave another word, confidence, and also we heard trust. So I think the important for all this is the monthly payment. A monthly payment also to help the consumer to spend. So I would like to know that what are the criteria to decide the monthly payment either before in the 2 years period or after 2 years period. I think you probably have those in your paper. Could you just briefly talk them about, and also more important is what the difference between these two periods. Thank you.
thank you for your question. So just let me clarify your question a little bit. So you're asking, what are the criteria for establishing the triggers for the trial period? Is that correct? And then how the trial period is different from the permanent period, the subsequent period. Okay, great, thanks. Just needed to clear it up. Well, we've set it up so that some portion of the 401k balances will be automatically converted into an income stream. And as Javi mentioned, we haven't defined exactly what that portion would be, but in subsequent discussion, we will narrow down that range. The trigger will be if you're allowed to take some portion of those assets as a lump sum. You can withdraw it over time, but when it hits a certain amount, say 10,000 or 10% of the value of the total assets in your 401k, then the trial payment will be triggered. There will be exceptions. So one of the exceptions would be that if it's a very small account, then it wouldn't be subject, if the plan sponsor participates in the trial, that account won't be subject to the trial income payment because it wouldn't make sense. If it's a small balance, the monthly amounts would be very small. So one of the criteria might be if it's above $100,000, for instance, then maybe half of those assets could be automatically defaulted into this income payment. There are also other exceptions. For instance, if you decide from the outset that you want to buy a lifetime income, then in spirit you've sort of met the idea of fulfilling this trial period. So then you can just go ahead and purchase your trial income payment. The difference between the trial and the permanent income option is, well, one is temporary and one is permanent. But there are other differences, and it might depend on how the plan sponsor or the employer decides to offer for those two periods. Now, Javi mentioned that there might be some pricing issue. If you're going to have to cash out or stop the payments after 2 years, it might not be a good value to offer a plan that has this longevity insurance included in it. It might just be too expensive. So one possibility would be that during this trial period, it would be some kind of managed payout, recalculated balance. And then when you get to the end of the trial period, they can automatically convert into a longevity insurance product or a lifetime income product with longevity protection.
So, yeah.
Hello, I'm Helen Raphael, Resources for the Future. If one elects a lifetime annuity and unfortunately dies within a couple of years, is there any capital left for one's estate? What does one do in that case?
You want to do that?
The scenario you refer to is a critical one to address. I mean, as Mike Wyand was saying, no trust is one concern, but no trust that you will actually get the money, even if you can trust the provider, is a major concern. Will I get hit by a bus soon after I purchase this? Will it all go to the insurance company? That is a risk that these products nowadays are helping people mitigate. That is, there are lots of death benefit products, either taking the form of a cash payment, cash surrender value, if you will, to the heirs of the deceased annuitant for the balance of the annuity value, or a life and X years certain pattern, where if the person dies early, the annuity continues to pay out for at least 10 years or at least 15 years. And we would encourage those kinds of flexible features that the market is in fact providing now increasingly, because otherwise we are going to get people stopping at the threshold and not willing to go with lifetime income.
I mean, remember, there's obviously a basic trade-off here between the more death benefit protection you build in and the size of what the monthly payments are going to be. So you need to try to find some kind of a reasonable balance with giving the participant a fair amount of choice. But you're helped in this proposal by the fact that only a portion of the 401k balance is going into this vehicle anyway. So that, combined with a reasonable amount of death benefit protection, should give you a product that people would want.
Right. I mean, we're not suggesting it's costless. On the contrary, the whole point of the annuity, or a large part of it, is the longevity risk pooling. And you're diluting that to the extent that you have some of these bells and whistles. But if we can't get people into the pure form, we don't want the proverbial perfect to be the enemy of the good.
It's perfect.
Okay. Are there any other questions?
Perfect role reversal for you and me.
If not, I want to thank everyone. I should say Andy Kaplan's is a PowerPoint at this stage, and the fully developed paper will be released in September, October. So you should certainly look out for that.